Welcome to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. Coming up, we'll talk with Sioux Falls businessman, military historian, and artist John Mollison, who, in his words, interviews old guys and draws their airplanes. One of those old guys is Colonel Hank Snow, who flew 666 missions in three wars. And to those who knew him, Colonel Snow was the greatest fighter pilot ever. Mollison tells his story in a new multimedia e-book. Also joining the program later this hour is filmmaker Justin Kaler. His new documentary, The Buffalo King, is the story of the man who helped save the buffalo from extinction. That man, Scotty Phillip. But first, SDPB Radio Statehouse reporter Victoria Wicks joins us from Pierre with today's legislative update. Hello, Vicki.
Hi, Carl.
And how are things in Pierre today?
Well, they're fine. There's a bill that was killed this morning that's probably going to make a lot of teachers happy that it went away. It was a proposal to allow school boards to opt out of continuing contracts with teachers. And Al Novstrup sponsored this bill. He's a senator from Aberdeen. He gave the reason so many bill sponsors are giving this session and possibly other sessions. He's the local control angle. He says school boards are the employers in this case, so they're closer to the situation.
Was this one of the elements in the reform bill package from last year?
Well, it is. Last year it was referred to as tenure, which, tenure doesn't exist at the K-12 level. But it was to eliminate continuing contracts, yes. The voters voted that down. So I think, Novstrup made the point that the voters possibly didn't object to everything. So, they're going to try a few piecemeal things.
Mm-hmm.
SDEA's Sandra Waltman spoke against it. She says that continuing contracts now offer a process for dismissal. This is not a job for life, as tenure is for higher education. After a period of probation, teachers can be dismissed. And before that period of probation, they can be dismissed at will. And afterwards, they have to have cause, and the teacher can't appeal that cause. She says there's a commission on teaching and learning that's being developed now to improve the teaching profession, so that should be interesting to see what comes of that. Administrators, school boards, teachers, legislators, and other stakeholders are taking part in that. And she talked about teachers as part of the community, and this is an aspect I hadn't thought about before. When I was in a fairly rural school, some of the teachers lived there and had married, and their kids were going to school there, and then others just kind of came and went. And she said that continuing contract can help a teacher make the decision to put down some roots and become part of that community.
So that bill doesn't go anywhere?
It doesn't, but it was only by a vote. I think it was four voted to kill it and three voted to move it forward.
There are also some news conferences today. Attended one with Governor Dugard.
Yes. Yep. The Democrats and Republicans hold theirs, and then the governor comes in. I asked the governor about the Lower Brule Tribe. I just saw this news item yesterday. The Lower Brule Tribe plans to build a casino and events center on trust land near I-90 and the Missouri River. And I kind of followed their progress. The state fought for 16 years to keep that piece of land out of trust. And the reasons I heard were that, to protect – they didn't want a casino there. They wanted to protect gaming in Deadwood. And because Deadwood pays sales taxes and a casino on trust land would not. The governor told me about the approval process. The tribe will consult with the local towns and counties and then the other tribes within 25 miles, and that would include Crow Creek. And then they present a plan to the Department of Interior, and after that the plan goes to the governor. And if he does not approve it, his decision cannot be appealed, he said. So I'm interested to hear what local governments and local business people around Lower Brule have to say, just because they're not paying tax from the casino operations directly. They are getting a big bump in their personal income, I would think, and they'd be spending that money in local stores and possibly buying some big-ticket items like cars and furniture and construction materials that they currently can't afford. And then, the state gets sales taxes from that. So it's a possibility that it could raise all boats.
All right. Well, thanks, Vicki. And tomorrow, the legislators have the day off?
They do.
Okay. So then we'll talk with you again on Monday.
I look forward to it.
All right. Thanks so much, Vicki. That's SDPB Radio Statehouse reporter Victoria Wicks, and you can hear her Statehouse updates on Dakota Midday through the 2013 legislative session, a few more weeks left. And you can find more coverage online at sdpb.org. You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke, and coming up later this hour, filmmaker Justin Kaler joins the program. He has a new documentary called The Buffalo King, and it's the story of the man who helped save the buffalo from extinction, Scotty Phillip. But first, John Mollison is a Sioux Falls businessman, artist, and military historian who, in his words, interviews old guys and draws their airplanes. He discovered that through his artwork, veterans would open up and share their stories. One of the veterans whose planes he drew was Colonel Harold Hank Snow. And Colonel Snow flew 666 combat missions in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, making him one of the U.S. Air Force's highest mission pilots. And to those who flew with Colonel Snow, he was the greatest fighter pilot ever. John Mollison tells his story in the new ebook, 666, The Devil's Number, The Amazing Service of Colonel Hank Snow, and he's with us in our studios at the University of Sioux Falls. And John Mollison, thanks so much for taking the time to join us on Dakota Midday.
Thank you.
Well, to begin with, when did your interest in drawing military airplanes and your interest in military history begin?
That was probably when I was a little boy. I drew pictures of airplanes based on the box art of my dad's model airplane kits, and my mom would keep me occupied by giving me crayons and paper.
So, unlike today, where you'd give a kid a video game or something, you were given a box to draw.
Yeah, that's literally what happened.
And it's, you know, a lot of times when we're that age, our interests, you know, they go elsewhere, and we forget those sorts of things. What was it about this that stuck with you?
Well, I think its airplanes are pretty cool. Mm-hmm. They're neat looking things. And especially the combat airplanes with the livery and the history and the story behind them. They're kind of dramatic, and they captivated me and my imagination. And same with the stories of the pilots and the history. There's just, I mean, what little boy doesn't get thrilled about that kind of stuff? Action and combat and valor and machines and great stuff like that.
So as you were drawing, then as you got older, you started researching more about the planes and the battles that they were involved in?
Yeah. My dad had a giant library of books, and I learned to read, I guess, at an early age, and I would read about all their stories of the pilots. I remember reading about Joe Foss when I was probably 4 years old. And it captivated me, and I just learned how to doodle. And then I had no idea that I wouldn't stop doodling.
and now what you're drawing, these aren't doodles. How would you describe these are authentic replications of these historic planes?
Yeah. And how those come about, the artwork, my artwork isn't that good. I mean, I'm not fooling anybody. But the artwork becomes to me an excuse to get the story and get the history. I'm much more interested in the history of America and the culture of change than I am the airplane. But when you have time with a veteran and you're going to draw their airplane, and that's kind of the payment of exchange of time, which sometimes can be years and years of interviews, I want to get it right. So I try to research the airplane as well as I can and make sure that the markings are as perfect as I can get them done. But I'm in it for the story.
When did you first start interviewing the men that flew these planes?
Oh, boy. That would be about 2002, 2001. I found out that it was just happenstance that I got to meet some of these guys from history, but I found out when you're talking to people who are twice your age and they've lived successful lives, to be a pilot in the Air Force, you're usually dealing with people who are intelligent, highly talented. They've also had a life that reflects the type of acumen it takes to be a combat pilot. And so when they tell you life history or they give you wisdom, I mean, it's usually pretty good stuff. And that's what I want to learn. I didn't really have relationships with my grandfathers. And so these guys have suddenly become not suddenly, I guess, but they've become the grandfathers I never had. So that's the underlying theme behind drawing these airplanes, is I get the backstory about who they are and what kind of people they've become.
Now, as I mentioned in the intro there, you were able to establish relationship with these men through your drawings. You didn't just walk up to them and say, "Hey, tell me about World War II."
No, it doesn't end well. It's taken a while to build up the kind of reputation that I'm still trying to build up, and that's a bit of cred as a historian, because you can't just walk up to somebody and go, "Yeah, tell me about your service." The first break, though, that I had as an aviation artist and historian came from Joe Foss. I drew his airplane, and I wanted to talk to him. The guy's a living legend. He's lived this huge life, and I wanted to find out what made him tick. And this was shortly before he died, the year before he died. He offered that. He goes, "Well, look, I'll spend a day with you if you would draw my airplane and then make prints and then let me hand it out as a fundraiser." And from there, I was able to kind of leapfrog and launch my way to meet other pilots. And he gave me my big break in terms of getting credibility. When a guy like Joe Foss says, "Yeah, I'll hand out your artwork," that's kind of cool.
So then through Joe Foss, you were able to then meet these other veterans?
Yeah, yeah. It was, and I had an online column where I would write about, this is going to sound like a real tangent, but they're actually connected. I would write about advances in technology in the gaming industry. And I would write specifically about Apple hardware and Apple technology. And at the time I was writing, this is 10, 12 years ago, one of the real defining benchmarks, so to speak, in technology and how it advanced came from the gaming industry, specifically flight simulators. And I knew I had a lot of readers who were flight simulator people, and they tend to be historians. And I was able to publish a story that I had when I happened to meet another historical figure, a guy by the name of Morris Jepson, who was on the Enola Gay when they dropped the atomic bomb. And I published the story, and my editor watched the traffic go from me writing about hardware and technological junk for the computer to when I started writing about history. It went from like 200 readers a week to I think it was 6,000. And that kind of said, okay, people are interested, and I've got an audience here. I want to try to cater to it.
What was that like to talk with someone like Morris Jepson, an important figure in history?
That was a trip. You know, you're dealing with a guy who worked with Teller and Oppenheimer, the guys who created the bomb. And this is Morris Jepson. He created the fusing mechanism. He was the last person to physically touch the atomic bomb. And he was there when it dropped and put on his dark glasses and all that other good stuff. When you're listening to it firsthand, history becomes profoundly real. And it changes your perspective of how you view yourself in the world. The world becomes very big, and that you're aware that there's a lot to learn about life. So what's it like to meet a guy like that and carry it forward? To me, it was inspirational.
So you're getting something that you don't get just from reading about these stories. When you meet these gentlemen and you hear their stories firsthand,
yeah.
What is at the heart of that? That you can't just get this out of a book. That doesn't change you.
Well, I think you can get it out of a book. I think that history writers and history as a genre or as a study just hasn't kept up with the rest of the world in terms of marketing themselves or understanding its impact. We've kind of accepted history as being something that you get from a teacher who's doing it just so they can bide time while they teach football or something like that. History is very important, and the vibe is changing. People are becoming fascinated with it, and they're becoming interested in it. And when they do that, when the audience does that, they place higher demands on people who want to teach or interpret history for others. So I think you can get it from a book, but it has to be crafted better. I'd like to think that we're on a great new wave of appreciation for history.
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke, and we're talking with Sioux Falls businessman, artist, and military historian John Mollison. He's published a new e-book called 666, The Devil's Number, The Amazing Service of Colonel Hank Snow. And John Mollison, as we've just been talking about, you've met and interviewed a number of World War II veterans. What is it about Colonel Snow's story that you wanted to put together a book about him?
Hank Snow experienced American history from a perspective that is just amazing. That's a pop term, but that's the only word that really comes about. He started his service in World War II, a Depression era kid, and ended it at the end of the Vietnam War. He saw America bright and dark and was right there in his combat missions. Those were not the easy missions. His 666 those were combat missions. Those were when he was putting himself in harm's way. So his story and what he saw over that expanse of 30 years is a tremendous glimpse into who we are as a country.
How unusual is it for someone to have served in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam?
That's a good question. I try to look into that, and the statistics aren't easy to get, so I'm not able to answer that with any type of qualification other than I've met a lot of combat aviators, and there's only a couple that I've heard that actually have 3 war experience.
And 666, that's a significant number for a couple of different reasons.
Yeah, that's the devil's number. And that's he had 100 missions in World War II, and he had 101 in Korea, and he had the rest of them, the combat missions and sorties in Vietnam. 2 tours.
Well, John Mollison, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be right back, and we'll talk a little bit more. This is Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke, and we'll be back with John Mollison in just a minute or so. And then later this hour, filmmaker Justin Kaler will join the program. He has a new documentary called The Buffalo King. It's the story of the man who helped save the buffalo from extinction. Welcome back to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke, and we're talking with Sioux Falls businessman, artist, and military historian John Mollison. He tells the story of Colonel Hank Snow in the new e-book 666, The Devil's Number, The Amazing Service of Colonel Hank Snow. And John, when did you first meet Colonel Snow?
2002.
And what was the context?
Oh, the context was I knew some of the squadron mates of World War II of Hank's, and I had done a print of these guys' airplanes, and they asked that Hank be included on this print. It's a print of 4 P-51 Mustangs, and they're stacked up in a line. And originally I was going to do 3 because I knew the 3 pilots, but they all said, nah, you need to put Hank on this print. And so I did his airplane and sent him off, and they got signed and all that other good stuff. I never met Hank up to the point that I was invited then to go to one of their reunions in Washington, D.C., and that's where I got to meet him firsthand.
And this was if I read, I think this is on your blog, that you were meeting with these guys, and what, you just asked who was the greatest combat pilot ever?
Yeah, I make a joke about it. That's the worst question you ask a fighter pilot, because it'll expose your naivete real quick, and it also exposes some pretty fragile egos. But after kidding aside, one of the fighter pilots looked over at Hank, who was actually flirting with my wife at the time, and said, "Now that the greatest fighter pilot the Air Force ever had would be that guy." And I looked over at him, and you know, that was Hank.
And he just walked over and introduced yourself, or what happened?
Yeah, I had been in the receiving line. He knew I was there. I walked over and I said, "Hank, I got to get your story someday." And it began a friendship.
And what was the nature of that friendship? Was it where you were just asking him stories or asking him questions? Or how did that relationship work?
Yeah, over time, what I've learned is these guys, especially from World War II, they adapted to technology easy, and so they all had email addresses. And after I left the reunion, I emailed Hank and would just ask him questions about what was that like, what was being in China like, what was it like to be on a base, you know, what kind of food did you have, you know, tell me about your childhood, those kind of things. And we'd email, and then after a while, the emails go from, well, how was your day at work, or tell me about your kids, and then you're exchanging Christmas cards, and then all of a sudden, this old guy is just part of your life.
One of the things that we should mention is that this book that you put together about Colonel Hank Snow is an e-book, meaning that there's it's a multimedia book. There's notes, photos, your drawings are in there, some personal things from Colonel Snow, and there's some very interesting photographs. And one that I'd like to point out is this photo of him when he's 4 years old, and he's wearing what looks like a three-piece suit, and he doesn't look like a four-year-old. He looks like a confident young adult.
Yeah, yeah. Hank, that's a cute picture. Hank saved, though, I think he saved everything. There just isn't too much that Hank doesn't have from his life. And when I saw that picture, I just thought, well, this has got to get in the book somehow. And I wanted to tell the story, not just about his combat, but give readers an idea of what kind of guy he, you know, what was life like growing up in the 20s and 30s, and what kind of culture and surroundings and environment, all that good stuff, would turn a guy into a fighter pilot who could adapt like Hank did, who could learn and carry through the traumatic changes in mission and politics that Hank was able to navigate.
And he grew up eating ketchup sandwiches, and he was a fan of Tom Mix.
Yep, ketchup sandwiches. Can you believe that? What self-respecting mother would serve her son and friends ketchup sandwiches? But they were grateful.
You mentioned negotiating the changes. He was in three wars, World War II, Korea, Vietnam. How did his... I'm wondering what his views on each of those wars were, if that changed, or it was just like this was his job. He was a combat pilot, and he did what he was supposed to do.
Yeah, military people aren't monolithic. I mean, they're thinking, breathing people, and they have various reasons that they serve, and the various reasons that they get involved. But there's no doubt that World War II, Korea, and Vietnam were different flavors. And Hank was very proud of his World War II service, and he was proud of his Korean service, and he was proud of his Vietnam service. But I try to write about the rules of engagement that became part of the culture of the Vietnam War, of how war can be dictated from miles and miles and miles away by politicians and by people who may have different agendas. Hank didn't appreciate that. And I've met other Vietnam pilots who didn't always appreciate that. But the thing that they do appreciate is they do appreciate honor and duty. And so they do their job, whether they like it or not.
When did Colonel Snow first step into a plane?
That would have been, I think, when he was, eight or nine. I don't know. Yeah, little guy.
Did he grow up with an interest then in flying? Was this something that he wanted to do?
Yeah, definitely. He, like every kid back then, you know, you look up and you see something buzzing overhead. I mean, even kids today, you know, little Cessna goes overhead and you crane your neck and you go, wow, I want to do that.
Now, what did he tell you about what he liked about flying?
I think for Hank, flying was a big freedom. And if you've ever been in a little airplane and been in control, it's just there's a tremendous freedom. Hank's personality, if you ever meet the guy, he's gregarious, he's outgoing, and he's one of those people who makes a friend of everybody in the room when he walks in. And the airplane to him was his way of just being out forward, moving, and have bright horizons, that type of thing. Flying is a metaphor for Hank.
Well, it certainly speaks to his love of flying that after he was out of the military service, he was a stunt pilot.
Yeah. I think that's, in my opinion, that's the best chapter of the book, because here you have a man who retired you would think that he would be tired after doing what he's done and the number of hours and the stress and all that other stuff of being in combat. But at age 66, he was still flying in air shows and he was still creating acts. And that tells me, Hank is one of many old guys who have given me a brand new perspective on what it means to age and what it means to get old and what it means to either, as the book, The Shawshank Redemption, get busy living or you get busy dying. Hank has always lived.
When did you last meet with him?
Last November, I flew out and spent a couple of days with him just to kind of get the vibe for the book and let him know that it was going to be an e-book and just get some last words with him before I dived into the project.
I'm assuming that he was fully supportive of this project.
Oh, totally. Yeah. He totally, and he got the technology right away. He knew that we needed to publish this as an ebook. Well, for one, for speed to market, we needed to go fast. But he also knows that, history needs to be portrayed and communicated in all of its vibrantness. History is very visual. And he had so many artifacts, so many pictures, all of his military documents, that he knew that the ebook is the best way to do it, or else you're going to have a coffee table book that weighed a ton. And so he was game on it. He even said, I think this is the only way we need to do it. We need to tell my story.
Is that because the reader is much more engaged because you're moving around in there, you're seeing things, there are links to visuals, that the photographs and the personal records that really this allows, that it's more interactive?
Yeah, the book itself is really a product of many years. I consume history and I consume biographies too. And I've always in the back of my head felt like we could be doing this better. We could be telling history better. And so we designed the pages, we designed the copy. I wanted to be able to produce a book that could be picked up and put down. If you're tired and going to bed, you just want to read a couple pages, that every page would be, it's kind of like its own standalone document, but that also consumed as a whole, it told a whole story. And the pictures of Hank's history are so powerful. My writing is I tried to keep that as minimal as possible. I wanted to make sure that whoever is reading it can experience the documents, to be able to really read his military certificates. Most people haven't really read what a DFC certificate looks like, or air medal, those types of things. And let people see the texture of the paper. Let people see how the Air Force writes a certificate. I mean, they do a great job. I mean, if you ever read one of these certificates of valor that accompany a medal, they're wonderfully done. I wish corporate America would take some cues from how these guys conduct their business. But I wanted to make sure that all those artifacts got a chance to be exposed to people who would normally never get to see them.
You just mentioned you wish people would take cues from the way these guys lived, and how you can take that and apply it to business and other things. What is it that you're learning, personally learning from these veterans that you've spoken to, and how are you able to apply that to your daily life and your work?
Well, boy, that's a great, great question. That one kind of landed with a big thud because there's so much to it. I've learned a lot about honor, and I've learned a lot about protocol that I get from being around people in the military. I've never served. I was too immature. Maybe I was too chicken, afraid to be doing push-ups or something like that. But what I've learned from being around the military is they've got just a phenomenally more advanced sense of honor and protocol that I wish you could find in the business world. I'm not saying that everybody in the military is perfect and they lead these saintly lives. There's politics, there's bad behavior, but there's less of it. And you find people who are, they get an idea of a bigger mission that I don't see as often in the private world.
Does your relationship with combat pilots, military veterans continue? Are you still continuing to draw planes in the war since World War II?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Like right now, I'm doing a B-52 that was part of the bombing of Cambodia in 1973, and I'm spending time with a pilot. And interestingly, because of the internet, you know, you show up on people's radar very quickly. And I'm also talking to a family of a young woman who her family was deeply affected by the Khmer Rouge. And so you draw this B-52, and all of a sudden you're talking to somebody who was part of, you know, very much touched by one of the greatest atrocities in the 20th century. And, you know, by the way, most people don't realize, I mean, when people think of atrocities in the 20th century, they naturally think and rightfully think of things like the Holocaust, which, you know, just curdles your blood. But then most people don't realize that stuff of just equal horrificness happened in Cambodia. And I like to share those stories, and I like to tell how people have changed and evolved. So, yeah, I'm deeply into this stuff. I'll never quit.
And you're going to Vietnam on behalf of a pilot you met?
Well, that's still kind of being worked out. Mm-hmm. It's actually hopefully to get to Vietnam as also part of a program to teach at a university. But I've met some POWs who were who were in Vietnam, and that has been opened up a whole new brain to me of, you know, what was their POW experience like? How did they get through it? And, you know, Vietnam right now is a country that's thriving and they're doing so well. And how do I reconcile how this country has grown and a whole new generation of people now are coming into the world? And if America is going to maintain its self and strength on the planet, we're going to have to deal with Vietnam. So, you know, what does that tell me, knowing the past and the future and the present? I don't know. I'm still forming this out, and I probably just bored you half to death with my little musings there. Sorry about that.
Well, we can wind things up here.
Oh, gosh.
Just to let people know that your book, 666, The Devil's Number, The Amazing Service of Colonel Hank Snow, is an e-book. And for people who are interested in checking that out, how do they find it?
Well, they can go to my website, johnmollison.com, and it's pretty easy to navigate. You can look and see the icon for 666, and that'll take you to a page on how you order it. And right now we're also formulating it for Kindle as well, but that won't be out ready for another 4 to 6 weeks.
And also on your website, see plenty of your drawings as well.
Yep.
All right. Well, John Mollison, thanks so much for taking the time to join us on Dakota Midday.
Oh, thank you very much.
That's John Mollison. He's author of the new e-book, 666, The Devil's Number, The Amazing Service of Colonel Hank Snow. And as you just mentioned, it's available on iTunes. You can also find it at johnmollison.com. He joined us from our studios at the University of Sioux Falls. You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke, and coming up after a short break, we'll talk with filmmaker Justin Kaler. He has a new documentary, The Buffalo King. It's the story of the man who helped save the buffalo from extinction, Scotty Phillip.